Today's daf in Masechet Pesachim is daf Lamed Aleph. Brought to you from Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, we're holding at the Halakha Mishnah on daf Lamed Aleph Beis. So we continue on now with the question of when exactly, how do we define the ownership of the chametz? Now this is something that we haven't discussed until now. We just sort of took for granted that ownership is a pretty straightforward issue. So in the previous Mishnah, where we talked about the difference between the chametz of a goy and the chametz of a Jew, it's pretty clear. One is the chametz of a goy and one is the chametz of a Jew. Now it turns out that we can work into kind of situations where it isn't really very clear whether the chametz belongs to a goy or the chametz belongs to a Jew. Now, how the heck is that possible? Very simple. Suppose one of the parties, the Jew goy, lends the other party, or goy Jew, and utilizes the chametz as a mashkan or as a mortgage. And we'll see these are not exactly the same things. So if he mortgages the chametz and then there's a default by the borrower, who owned the chametz during the time of the loan that was defaulted? Is it that if I mortgage this chametz to someone and I end up defaulting on my loan, then that someone actually owned the chametz from the time that he lent me the money, which it turns out I never paid? In other words, the way to view that type of relationship would be that somebody says, look, I'm giving you this money. I don't really trust you. And in the event that you are not going to be paying me back, so then basically what I'm doing is I am buying what it is that I'm telling you is a mortgage. But I'm making a condition that you're able to buy it from me in the event that you do pay me back. So then that would mean that we view the loan essentially as payment for the chametz. On the other hand, we can just say, look, at the point in which I don't pay you back, once the loan is defaulted, then at that moment and only from that point forward, I can go and I can collect the money, but the chametz, but it wasn't my chametz up until now. So as you can see, that will have profound implications on the din. Whose chametz is it during Pesach? Now, if we're going according to Rabbi Shimon, that there's this, assuming that, again, we could have learned like Rabbi Yehuda and understood that we darshan from Lo Yelecha, but whatever the halacha would be, there would be the major difference between who it was that owned the chametz. Is the chametz mutter after Pesach, or is the chametz osir after Pesach? So this is what our Mishnah comes to address, and that's why it appears right here. It's actually perfect. We discussed the difference between the chametz of a goy or a Jew after Pesach. Now we want to know, how do we know if it's the chametz of a goy or a Jew? So Nochri Shilva et Yisrael al Chimtso. So now, suppose a goy lends money to Yisrael against the chametz. He's got like $100,000 worth of chametz. This guy is a big distributor of chametz. And he takes a loan and he gives the entire stock of his chametz to the lender. And he says, if I don't pay you up, then, you know, the chametz is yours. In the end, he doesn't pay him up. So this is what we're assuming the case is. So then, Acher Pesach, it's mutter b'hana'a. Then that would mean it belonged to the goy during Pesach. Wow, that's a big kiddush. So in other words, during the time that it could still have been paid up, we still view it as the goy's chametz for some reason. Apparently because a mortgage that isn't paid belonged to the lender from the beginning. And vice versa, we say the opposite. Yisrael shilva et nochri achimtso. If the Jew is the one who lent the money to the goy, then that would mean that if the goy defaults, that the chametz belonged to the Jew all along. And because of that, after Pesach, it is osur bahana'a. And actually, we're going to be talking about a case, as we will see, where the chametz had been moved into the house, property, warehouse of the lender. So it was in the goy's rishus, and now there was no need for him to go to court to collect or anything else. The moment that the Jew defaults, it's in his rishus automatically. So we seem to be saying it was there all along. Now, it will turn out there's some very complex legal issues that are involved here in the determination of who owned the chametz during Pesach. And the implications for who owned the chametz during Pesach are not only vis-a-vis the question of the heter of chametz shavah lava Pesach, depending on whether the owner is Jewish or not, There also seem to be on the surface some very important issues, such as, for instance, I mean, suppose the borrower goes ahead and he makes it Kodesh. So does the lender, is now lender stuck with the fact that, uh-oh, there went my chametz and now it belongs to Hegdesh. I can't collect it. Suppose he sells it to somebody else, that kind of thing. So the first thing the Gemara wants to do is dispense with those concerns, because those concerns involve another component that is not central to understanding the chametz issue. Because there are two aspects that go into the nature of ownership. One of them is the question of the rights of ownership, which does not necessarily mean the rights to the value of ownership. So I can have rights of ownership because something is mine and therefore I can determine what I want to do with it, but I have no rights if I have given away the financial rights to someone else. So therefore, for me to go ahead and to sell a house, let's say, that's mortgaged to someone else where I don't own anything at all. So then Jeff is saying this is called beneficial ownership. Which one is called beneficial ownership? When I don't have it, reshuto, there's two concepts in Lashon HaKodesh. One of them is beito, and the other one is reshuto. So normally we learn out ish ki akdish et beito means just like beito usually implies two things. It's his house and he's living in it and so on, but it's also reshuto. It is in his possession financially to determine its financial dispensation. Which one of them is called, Jeff?
Beneficial is when you have the ultimate right or not, the rights to it, but you can benefit from anything from ownership, whether it's in your possession or not.
Okay, so then beito is beneficial ownership, and the other one would be called possession in English?
Generally.
Okay, fine. All right, so those are the two concepts. So therefore, the Gemara wants to set aside our concerns about reshuto when it comes to chametz, because that isn't the point of chametz. The lecha is not to be defined by the reshuto. So therefore, in the case we have, first of all, let's understand the general machlokas. So this seems to be saying that wherever there is a situation of a mortgage, when a loan is defaulted, then according to Abaye, the default simply lets us know that all along, the loan was not a loan. The loan was basically a purchase. And it turns out that it was owned by the individual who purchased it, so to speak. That is to say, the lender now turns out to be a purchaser, according to Abaye. So it was his all along. Now, this has obvious implications for our mission. We will point out that there seems to be a question about how to understand the Mishnah if you don't say that. Rava Amar Mikan Alabahu Govet, where it's Rava says, no, when the loan is defaulted and you collect it, then it's yours. Now, let me make clear that Kolechada Agdish Lov, Vizavin Lov, let's say that the borrower went ahead and he was gave away this chametz to Hegdish, or he went and sold it to somebody else. There's no question. He was not in possession because there's liens against it. He can't do whatever he wants against the lien. And because of that, of course, the Malva, the lender, can come along and say to the guy who drove away with his chametz, excuse me, sir, you'll be putting that right back into the warehouse because this guy had no right to sell it. Now, the truth is that theoretically, you ought to be able to do the same thing with Hegdish, you know, because in order for a person to be makdish something, it has to be in his possession. And that, as I told you, we learn that from the pasuk of Ish ki akdish et beito, which implies both levels. I'm actually living there and I'm in possession of it, which is the norm. However, because the Rabbonin were concerned that if somebody just drives into Hegdish and drives away with things that belong to Hegdish without having exchanged any money for it, people may think that it is possible to remove Hegdish without an exchange, because they'll think that there actually had been a Hegdish over here. And the truth is that that cannot happen. There needs to be some physical exchange, which is the idea of pidyon, in order for Hegdish to be Yotzei. So to avoid the issue of Hegdish people thinking Hegdish Yotzei below Pidyon, therefore we say, okay, you know what? Give $1 at the Pidyon Center, walk up to the desk, give a dollar, get yourself the ticket that allows you to take the Hekdesh. And that way, nobody is going to think that the Hekdesh actually was able to be transferred without a pidyon. But that's just to avoid it looking bad. In reality, Hekdesh never owned it at all. Now, again, there's a slight issue over here, which is that you may recall that Hekdesh is mafkia she'ibudim. Hekdesh can cancel liens, in which case, why in this case does the Hekdesh not cancel the lien of the mortgage? And that is very simple. The din of Hekdesh being mafkia she'ibud is only the reality of Kedusha, which is called Kedushat HaGuf. It is not the ownership of Hekdesh, which is called Kedushat Damim. The ownership of Hekdesh is no different than anybody else's ownership. And therefore, all liens will still be honored, even if somebody gave away a field to Hekdesh. If this were a mortgage on an animal, and then there was a question of the person making it Kodesh, but Kedushat HaGuf, then we would run into issues of how does Kedushat HaGuf affect liens. But that's not our problem over here. Okay, so in the case where the borrower went ahead and he made it Hekdesh, so then fine, the lender would have to pay a little bit of money, you know? He'd have to give a buck. So he would be Otam Alvin, he would be Mefarakit, the Tlan Mosif O Dinar, Upode et Anechasima Elo. Yeah, this is not good. I just got advance notice of a migraine. Hold on one second. Let me hope that I could finish the daf before, while I can still see. Shoot. I can't believe this. So he's Mosif O dinner, Upodat and Echasima Elo. The question over here is, what if the lender was the one who sold it, or the lender was the one who made it Kodesh? So Abaye says, the mafreya who goved, and when it turns out that ultimately the guy defaults on it, now it turns out that it belonged to him from the beginning, and it was a good Hekdesh, shaper Hekdesh, shaper Zavin. And Rava says, no, it's only from the point that he actually collects after the default. And therefore, if the guy, if you own something, could somebody else come along and pay you money and throw you out of your property? Of course not. And in this case, the guy can pay you up and say, get out of here. So how could you claim to have owned it? Since ilu havi lezuzi havi mesalik lebezuzi, so it turns out, ishtakech tahashtak kokari, and it was only from this point on that he did this. Okay, that's the machlokas. The obvious implications for the Mishnah we're setting aside for a moment, because we want to make absolutely certain that we have these shitas correct of Abaye v'Rava. Because you're claiming that Rava said that a person actually only collects after there's a default. I don't think that's possible. Mi'omar Rava Hachi. Didn't Rami Bar Chama say, now this is a fascinating case, I can't believe this. I was so looking forward to teaching this with a full heart. Oh, God. It's such a brilliant case. It's not a case that deserves a migraine, I got to tell you. Anyway, Reuven sells a field to Shimon, and he sells it with Achrayut. Achrayut means that in the event that it turns out that Shimon loses the field because if the field was leaned to another creditor of Reuven's, then Reuven has to pay Shimon back for the loss. And that guarantee is also covered by a lien against everything, any real estate that Reuven owns. Now, Reuven dies and he leaves heirs. Shimon, meanwhile, hasn't paid a solitary cent for this field, because basically he didn't have any money, and Reuven was zakfa alav kemilva. So he made a mortgage out of it. He said, okay, the field is yours. The sale is finished. He signs off. And now he takes a lien against his own field that he just sold to Shimon. And now Shimon owes him the full value of the sale. Fine. Everything is great. Shimon now owes this money to Reuven's heirs. The problem is that after Reuven dies, before Shimon pays the field up, a creditor of Reuven, who hears that Reuven has died, shows up at the doorstep and tells Shimon, look, I have a lien against this field that Mr. Reuven sold you. And unfortunately, he owes me the full value of that field. So I'm afraid I will be collecting it. So Shimon says, what? I wanted this field for years. You know what? I haven't paid yet for the field and I just came into some money. How about if I pay you off? So now he pays off the debt and he gets to keep the field. Now what happens is that Reuven's kids come and say, our father died and we have a shtar here for a mortgage that you owe our father, $100,000 for a field. Oh, says Shimon, that field? I paid the whole thing off. I had to pay it off to your father's creditor. So the kids say, that's not our business. When our father died, he left us only metal to him. We have some money in the bank. There was also money that was due in the bank. I think it was actually signed by you, a $100,000 mortgage. But that isn't property. I mean, that is called money in the bank. A creditor does not have the right to collect from heirs for money in the bank. He can only collect in actual fields because he has a lien against. So he doesn't have a lien against your mortgage. So that's not our business. We know that you owe us $100,000 and you didn't pay for the $100,000. So Shimon says, you know what? That's really a cute argument. But since I paid $100,000 and your father had guaranteed that if I do end up losing that money, he's going to pay me back, you owe me that money anyway. So I'm going to look at him and say, we owe you that money. How could we owe you money for our father when our father didn't leave us any property? So therefore, you're up the river over here and without a paddle. We want our money. So Rava, now this is absolutely true. What they're saying is absolutely true legally. Now Rava says, if Shimon's got any brains, this is what he'll do. He will say, oh, gee whiz, I don't have any cash. I guess the only thing that you kids can do is collect the field that I bought from your father. Okay, so they collect the field that he bought from the father. The next day, Shimon shows up with a court order that says that this field is his. What? We just collected it. Yeah, but your father owed me money in the event that someone would collect the field from me. And since you now, apparently your father did leave you a field, here I see the field here. Therefore, I'm gonna be collecting this field in lieu of the achrayut, the guarantee that your father offered, which you claimed yesterday, that you don't have any field from your father to pay me back. And I see there's a field right here in front of me. And that field is owed me. Okay, so now he goes, takes the field back. And basically he only had to pay once for that field. Now, obviously this will only work if Rava does not agree with himself. If Rava agrees that if a mortgage is defaulted, then it means that it was owed the whole time. So therefore, when Shimon defaults on the mortgage and he says, I'm not going to be able to pay you for the field, and you now collect as the children, you're the heir of Reuven, it turns out that Reuven left you a field because the field was actually his the whole time. Brilliant. But the problem is that that's not what Rava holds. Rava holds that the deal is you only get the field from this point forward. Now, let's imagine for a moment that the Yesomim would have used the cash and they would have bought a field. Suppose he had paid them up with cash and they would have bought a field. Can he come and say, oh, your father left you a field? Of course not. This is the cash that was left us. We used it to buy a field. So your darn business. This did not belong to our father. So if Rava holds as he does that the collection is only from that point forward, then it's purely coincidental that the field that happens to currently belong to these heirs looks exactly like the field that was originally owned by their father, because it's not their father's field. It's basically a field that they collected from this point forward, as if they had bought it with their own cash, right? So this means that Rava doesn't hold like Rava. Rava holds like a buyer. Now, come on, how are you going to explain that, says the Gemara? So therefore, comes along now Let's just see that inside. So Reuven died. And now Ata Balchov de Reuven. And he was Torifle Mishima. And Shimon went ahead, Upaise, and he paid him up Bezuze. The din is that the B'nai Reuven, the heirs, could come along and say to Shimon, and they could tell him, listen, the only thing that our father left us, B'tatele Shavak Avon Gabach, B'tatele the Yasme are not really Meshubah to pay off any loans, okay? So Rava says, well, if Shimon's got any brains, Pikeach Shimon, he will claim that he doesn't have any cash, and then they will have to collect the field from Shimon, and then he'll collect the field from them. Because as Rav Nachman said, if Yitomim collect property that their father owed, that was owed to their father, right? So they collect it because he had a mortgage against it, then a creditor of their father can come along and collect that property from them. And in this case, I, Shimon, am the creditor of your father. So I was both a debtor to your father and a creditor of your father. Perfect. So now it works out that I collected the very property that you collected from me. What's the difference if it's somebody else or it's mine? It's exactly the same. So beautiful. So this only works out bishlam if you're the mafreya who go there. That would explain why Amtalach chos v'govo tamiyam. Then he can go back and collect it from, because it was as if it belonged to him from in his lifetime. Come on, degavu michaya de'avuim. But if you're going to tell me that Rava holds like Rava, so then am I chos v'govo tamiyam? It's as if command dissolving liatme nichsei dami. It's as if they went ahead and bought property with their own money, and let's say they would have done that. Of course not. It's not going to be meshubah to anybody else if they go out and buy property with money that was left from their father. Answers the Gemara, that is a brilliant question, but there's a way out of the question. Rava is not relying on the issue of having been gova lemafreya, because you don't need in that case to be gova lemafreya. Actually, what Rava was saying was that there was a different halach, and he was saying like this: look, Shaini Yosem, the Armalahu, he tells the Yosami that the same money that was meshubed to your father from me was meshubed from your father to a balchov of your father, and therefore is considered to be directly leaned to the balchov of your father. How do we know that? Well, we know that from a concept called Shibuda de Reb Nosson. Shibuda de Reb Nosson is a fantastic principle in ownership in terms of rights, and that is financial rights. And that is, if A owes B money and B owes C money, then A owes C money. And that we can view that as a direct lien to C. How does he know that that's true? Because the Torah talks about a case where if somebody stole money and swears that he didn't, and then, you know, the whole story, we have to add 25% because of the fact that you swore b'sheker. Anyway, so it says you have to pay it back. And it says you pay it back la'asher ashamlo. You pay back the extra fine of 25% to, instead of saying Laman de Noshevo or Laman de Ganav Mimenu, it says Lasher Ashamlo. Now, what does that mean? In the context over there, the din of the word Asham is the meaning of the original principle as opposed to the fine. So Lasher Ashamlo means whoever is the real owner of that principle, from which we learn out that if the person that you had stolen it from owed that money to somebody else, that's the one, Lasher Ashamlo, and that's the one that you need to pay, which is a tremendous chiddush. Now, if that's true, then what Shimon is saying to them is, listen, gentlemen, heirs of Reuven, I owed money to your father, and it was money leaned, that either was an actual mortgage for. And your father owed money to somebody else. Guess what his name is? Me. You? Yeah, absolutely. Because your father guaranteed me against any loss of that field. And I lost $100,000 due to his ridiculous non-payment of his debt before he died. So he owed me that money. That means that the mortgage to your father was mortgaged to me. Therefore, I am collecting my field. in lieu of the payment of your father's guarantee, because it was mortgage fee. That has nothing to do with collecting it from your father as if your father had owned the field while he was alive. He never owned the field while he was alive. I admit it. But so what? There was a mortgage to me from this field from before. That's what's important. And I'm going to utilize that mortgage. So this is all based on a completely different halacha, and it would have nothing to do with the idea of whether the Baal Chov is considered to be the owner from the beginning or not. So let's just see that inside, if I can make it. So over there, it's different. Shani Asam, the Amar Lahu Ki Echad Ishtabadna Le'Lavuchon. Same way, I was mortgaged. I was leaned to your father to pay. I was also automatically leaned to anyone who to whom your father owed money. That's based on Shibud de Reb Nasa. The Tanya Rabbi Natan Omer. How do you know that the mortgage goes directly to the final, the address of that mortgage? Okay, so therefore we're left with our original machlokas. Now, let us now take a look at how the Mishnah is relevant to this machlokas, because boy, oh boy, it sure seems to be that that's the whole point. It says in the Mishnah, Nochri she'ovat Yisrael al chimtso. The din is that achra pesach mutter b'ana'ah. Now, why is that? Because if he defaulted, then it turns out that you're saying that it was owned the whole time by a goy and not by a Jew. But that's only if you hold l'mafreya hu gove. So bishlama yamet b'mafreya hu gove, that would explain why it would be mutar b'ana'ah, because the goy owned it from the very beginning, since the Jew defaulted on his loan. But if you're going to tell me mikana lahabahu goveh, so then why would it be mutar b'ana'ah if it was the Jew's chametz all Pesach long? How do you explain that? It was b'reshut of Yisrael habikoi. That's true. That's a big problem according to Rava. And Rava will have to explain that the only way that this works is that rachav b'mayaskinan kishehir hinu etzlo. Since it's talking about over here that the chometz was physically moved to the warehouse of the goy, so because of that, it didn't belong to the Jew. Why not? What does moving it have to do with it? I mean, it would just be like leaving it in somebody else's warehouse. That doesn't bother me from bayirah bayimatzai. Because the point over here is that we are now changing this from mortgage to mashkan. So in the event that you gave something as a mashkan, there's a whole other parsha in the Torah. And that is the parsha of pajamas. So suppose, as it says, you go and you want to collect a debt. The person says, I can't pay you now. I'll pay you in a week. And you say, look, I don't trust you. I want you to give me a mashkan. So the guy says, well, I have a pair of pajamas I can give you as a mashkan. Okay, so I take his pajamas. Now there's a fantastic Kiddush in the Torah that if you took pajamas as a mashkin and it's the only pair of pajamas that the guy has, then you have to give him back the pajamas every night to wear, and then you can collect it, take it back in the morning. And the Lashon of the Pasuk is Ulecha tiyet tzedakah. This will be considered for you an act of tzedakah. Aha. So Tainus Rabbi Yitzchak, if it's considered to be an act of tzedakah, it must be that it's yours, right? You must own it. So what that shows, because otherwise, how can you give tzedakah with someone else's pajamas? So the point is that when you give him these pajamas, you are doing a charitable act to him from something that you actually have a kinyan in, which shows that a Baal Chov is kone amashka. So as opposed to a mortgage, which requires collection, the whole point of a mashkan is that it's already in my rishus and therefore has been collected in advance. What we're utilizing over here is not the rights to the mortgage. We're utilizing the rights to the mashkan. So therefore, if we're assuming that the goy also has these rights, so that when he takes the chometz as a mashkan into his warehouse, he becomes the owner in the sense that Rashi understands it, in the sense of having full responsibility for anything that happens to it. If a fire breaks out or whatever, it's hit by lightning, it's going to be his loss. It's as if he already collected it. So then if that would be the case, that would explain why it really does belong to the guy during that time, because the guy was Kohen Mashkan. So as opposed to the simple way of understanding the Mishnah, that it's a question of Lebafreo who go over, Mikhail Abba who go over, we've changed the case to make it possible for Rava's Shita to survive. And even if you're Mikhail Abba who go over, since it was Hirhinu Etzlo and it was in the warehouse of the Goy the whole time, because of that, it was considered to be, when the Jew defaulted, it was considered, in fact, to have been that Mashkan belonged to the Jew, belonged to the Goy, and therefore it was his own without coming on to the question of whether Lemafreo Hugova or not. That's how we understand it now. Okay, shall we say, as the Gemara, that the getting back to the Machlokas of Abaye Verava, do we have a right to say that the Machlokas of Abaye Verava is itself a Machlokas Tanoi? Because here in the Braita, it turns out that not everybody agrees with the case as it's mentioned in the Mishnah. So the Braita says like this, Yisrael shilvel nachriyachem. So, if a Yisrael lends, this is the second case in our Mishnah, Yisrael lends his money against the chometz of a goy, then la'achra pesach eino over alav mishum, mentioned to the mishum on this, but he's not over because of chometz shavalav pesach. That's against our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that if the Jew is the one who ends up getting the chametz, then it was his all Pesach. Now Rabbi Meir says, like the Mishnah, Mishum Rabbi Meir Amru, that no, actually he is over. Aha, okay, so there you go. Apparently the Machlokas is that the Tatana Kama in the Braita disagrees with our Mishnah and holds that the halacha is that he was Mikana Abu Gov, and Rabbi Meir holds that since Lemafreya Hugove, it belonged to him all Pesach long, and therefore he was over in the Tzvam Travel of Pesach, which is exactly the machlokas between Abaye Verava, says the Gemara. Come on, you read the rest of it, and you'll see that that does not make sense, okay? Read the rest of the Braita, V'tizbra, Eima Sefer. You think that that's a good explanation? If the Braita had stopped there, maybe it would have been. But how do you understand the rest of the Braita? It says over there that in the inverted case, which is the Mishnah's first case, where the Nochri lent money to the Yisrael against the Yisrael's chametz, then everybody is moda that he was over, he will be over on Chomesh Rav HaPesach, which is the exact opposite of the Mishnah. Now, but before we discuss why it's the opposite of the Mishnah, can you explain to me why in the inverse case we just don't give the inverted halacha? It should simply be the exact opposite, right? It would ipcha mi boilei, we should have said. The one who said in the first case that he's not over would say in this case that he is over, because mikana l'abba. The one who says in that case he was over, in this case would say he's not over, because l'mafreya hu gova. So obviously, we are not talking about the machlokas of Abaye Verava in this case. And therefore, you're going to have to give me a better explanation of why it makes a difference about whether it was the Jew who lent the money to the Goy against the chametz, or it was the Goy who lent the money to the Jew against the chametz, and why in the world it wouldn't simply be the same situation in the inverse, in which we need to decide whether l'mafreya hu gova or mikana l'abba hu gova. Therefore, this machlokas itself is Nogea the case where it was a mashkan, and it was talking about Kagon Shirhino Etzlo. So when the Goy lent the money, that meant that the chometz was transferred to the Goy's warehouse. Where the Jew lent the money, it meant that the chometz was transferred to the Jew's warehouse. And the machlokas over here is in the din of Rabbi Yitzchak, which we spoke about a moment ago. The Omer Rabbi Yitzchak, Minayin Lebal Chov, Shekone Mashkan. How do we know that somebody who lends money and takes a mashkan on it is actually considered to be an owner of that mashkan? If you give him back his pajamas, it will be considered an act of charity. Now, how can you do charity with money that isn't yours? So in Eino Kone Mashkan, can you explain to me how the Torah could call it tzedakah? Mikan lebalchov shekone mashkan. Okay, that's Rabbi Yitzchak's din. Now, apparently, that's the machlokas over here. The Tanakama holds, it's all very nice, if a Jew lends a Jew, then he is kona mashkan because the Torah said so. But your case is talking about a goy. We're over there, since we say Yisrael, Yisrael, we say l'chot yetzidaka. But a Yisrael who takes a mashkan from a nochri, which was the first case, he would not be kona because the Torah never said that you're supposed to give him his pajamas back. Whereas Rabbi Meir says, I mean, come on, man. If the Torah gave a Yisrael the ability to be kona a mashkan from another Yisrael, so Kol Shekein, if he takes a mashkan from a goy, he may not have to give him back his pajamas, but certainly the financial dispensation is not going to be better in the favor of the goy than it would be in the favor of a Jew. So in that case, of course, the Torah is giving him a kinyan on the mashkan. But in the second case, where the Nochri was the one who lent the Yisrael against the mashkan of his chametz, everybody is maida. That, of course, the goy does not have a kinyan on a mashkan. Where would the goy have been given that kinyan in the Torah? So, therefore, a nochri miyisrael is certainly lo kane. And that explains the only way that we actually... Oh, I forgot to record. That explains the only way that we can actually understand this bright, and therefore it's irrelevant to the machlokas of Abaye v'Rava. Okay. Tonight. So now, let's get back to the Mishnah. Nochri shilva liyisrael al chimtso achra pesach mutar bahana'a. How do you explain that? I mean, even if we're going now, because before you said, I can explain it according to Rava by saying that he put it in his warehouse. But now we're saying that everybody agrees that putting it in his warehouse doesn't help one bit because he's a goy, and therefore he doesn't get a right to ownership of it. So even if you said before, Nihinami der, he knew it's so fine, I understand, he moved it to the warehouse. But you said that doesn't matter if you moved it to the warehouse because a goy is not kona mashkan from Yisrael. So how do you explain this whole business? Ah, I'll tell you how I explain it according to the way Rava's got no choice. I will say the Mishnah is talking about when we said, yes, he was here, hino etzlo, but he also made a specific condition, namely that in the event that the debt is not paid back by day X, then it is from this moment on considered to be yours. So he told him, me achshav. And since he told him, me achshav, therefore, it is considered to be, in this case, since it's in his rishos, please mute yourself, since it's in his rishos and does not require any further act of collection, the mashkan is the collection, and with the giving of the rights by telling him the condition of me'akshav, then it's no problem. And according to Rava, everything would fit in fine, even if in terms of a mortgage, it would only be mikana lahapa. So it works out perfectly well. And that would be the difference. The difference is if you said me'achshav or not, and those were the differences as well between the case in the Mishnah and the case in the Braita, where you said in the case of the Braita is a complete contradiction to the Mishnah. No, it's not. Because there's a difference in saying me'achshav. So how do you amar le'me'achshav or lo me'amar le'me'achshav? Wait, how do I know that just saying me'achshav makes the difference in ownership? Because I know this from an actual case where a goy, and this is a brayta that talks about pat purani. Now, pat purani is the difference in those days. Remember, standard pot was what we call pitot, because the standard household oven was this little oven that they would put on the ground, and then they would put the pot around the side of the oven. Pat purani is what we would call bread baked in an oven. Now that was very uncommon to find in a person's home, and that you would actually need to go to a bakery where they would have a large oven that was big enough to put a loaf of bread in. And that, it's amazing how recent that was, because when I first got here to Eretz Yisrael, it's close to 60 years ago, the only ovens, people that wanted to bake bread for Shabbos, you would bring the bread to the baker, and that bread was your bread, and then you would come back and collect it. So because of that, they used to do this for the cholent as well. They would keep the cholent in the bakery because the oven was hot enough to keep the cholent warm. Anyway, so in those days, it was, that was the standard. So if a guy had pat purani, which is like what we call a loaf, that was very expensive. Okay, so a guy over here, a goy, he gives a loaf of bread as a mashkan for money that the Yisrael is giving him. So the deal is that he would not, the Jew is not going to be over on Baal Yerah. It's not considered to be his. But if the guy said to him, listen, it's yours if I don't pay up, so then he is over. Well, what do you mean it's yours? Must be that he said, it's yours from now. That shiny he says, listen, this is your bread. If I don't pay up, no, there's not even nothing to discuss between us. This is yours. So that means you collect from now. Shmamina, that indeed there's enough kamina between saying me'akshav and not saying me'akshav. So now everything fits in. We've got two completely different approaches. One, which was very fortunate for Abaye, that we could be talking about a case of a mortgage, and it would be based on the idea of lemafreya hu goveh. And the other is that it's talking about a situation of mashkan, and even though normally we wouldn't say that he's going to mashkan because he's a goy, when he says me'akshav, then it's as if the collection had already taken place from now. Okay, beautiful. So now we understand how to determine who the owner is. Is the owner Jewish or is the owner a goy? Tana Rabban, a chanut, how about in a case of determining chashash? Now, I understand you made it very clear who things belong to, but I'd like to understand what I have to worry about. So let's imagine a case like this. There's a Jewish store, and all of the stock in the store is owned by a Jew, and there is chametz in the store, and there's all kinds of other stuff in the store, and you've got these goyim that work in the store. So then, if any kind of chometz is found in that store after Pesach, the guy did not sell his chometz, I cannot attribute the chometz that I find there to a stock boy who dropped a piece of bread, therefore belonged to the goy. I have to assume that it's all usur bahana'a. And obviously, for achila, it's usur, but it's considered to be straight out chometz shavalov ha-pesach. How about in the opposite case? You've got a store, it's a non-Jewish store, it's the entire stock is owned by non-Jews. Happened to be that Jews work there. So it's filled with Jewish workers. Now comes after Pesach and I find chometz. Do I have to worry that the chometz dropped from one of the Jewish workers? Or can I assume that it all is fell from the stock? Now, halacha is over there, it's even mutter to eat. Kol shekein, it would be mutar bahana'a. The ein tzarich lomar, that it would be mutar bahana'a. Okay, Sir Richard.
So the Halakha Mishnah.
Now that we've decided who owns what, let us decide what is considered to be automatically mivuar, where it's not my concern. And suppose the house actually collapsed over the chometz. I had a chometz in my kitchen and it was full, all the cabinets were full, the roof collapses over that. Do I have to take care of it and get a construction crew in, get out all of the chometz and get rid of it? No. Chometz shenafel av mapolet has a din of actually being mivuar, and therefore I'm not going to be over on Bayera'eh Bayimatzeh because it's not considered to be mine at all, because it says Shivat Yamim lo yimatzeh lo yimatzeh bevateichem, and bevateichem means has to be similar to vatechem. Now, this is actually related to what we talked about before. There we said, ma betcha b'shutcha, in nogea, your ability to sell something or to be madesh something. The Zifri makes the same drasha, Bechilta makes the same drasha over there about the chometz. Only if it is actually in your possession, that is to say your control. Since over here, there is no way that you can get to it, it's not considered to be yours. Reb Shimon ben Gamliel omer, well, now, it actually depends a little bit. I mean, we're talking about a case where kosher ina kelev yochol lechapes acharav. This is only if it's not going to be dug up by the doggy who is looking for some bones. So that needs to also be part of it, because otherwise it is still considered to be accessible enough that it's going to show up during Pesach, and therefore you have the same chiyuvim to be mavayer. Amar Rav Chisda, there's another point over here, and that is, it's true that you can rely on it as mevuar. However, if this happened, let's imagine that this happened after, you know, you'd already done your original bir chometz, your bittul chometz in the evening, you're still going to need to be mevatel all of this chometz, because we're always concerned that if something happens and there's an exposure of the chometz, so then we don't want you to be over for that moment. Remember we said before. And therefore, you need to be mevatel belipcha, even though you were already mekayim the bir chometz, because we always have that chashash for that moment that the chometz is exposed, that you shouldn't be over before you have a chance to burn it. Anyway, what would be considered to be within the range of a dog digging up? Kama chafisat chalav. What is the amount of material that needs to be buried under? That shlosha tvachim, that's a serious collapse. Three tvachim deep. Shmuel said that if you were given money to keep in trust for someone, you're a shomer on that money. If you don't bury that money underground and it's stolen, then you are considered to be a poshea and you would be chayev because you didn't watch it. So you'd be chayev on it even if it was stolen. You were normally, as a shomer chinam, you'd be potter. Now, when he says you have to bury it underground, did he also mean this shear of three tvachim that we just said about chapishat kelev? Omar Lein, no, of course not. When you're talking about food, you need to worry about the smell of the food and its possible attraction to a dog. So, there you need shlosha tvachim, because the dog may pick up on the smell. But over here, when you're talking about ganavim, there, it's not the smell of money that we're talking about. We're talking about the mechase me'enav. And over there, you don't need shlosha tvachim, obviously. Okay, well, I mean, how much do you need, at least in order to avoid the possibility of it's just becoming uncovered? The kama, oma rafram bar papa misichra, a shear of one tefach is sufficient to rely on, that it will not become uncovered accidentally.